This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Hello, hi, and welcome back to the future with this week's episode of Equal Agenda, being about the past, present and future of feminism. So this week for the historic figure, Roman.
We're looking at Mary Wollstonecraft. So she was the sort of first big, like, female feminist, which sounds a bit strange, but at the time after the Renaissance, even during the Renaissance, most big political thinkers who supported feminism and women's rights were still men. And Mary Wollstonecraft was sort of the first to become super popular advocating for feminism. She was born in 1759 and died in 1797. She was more of a sort of radical for her time, so she was influenced by the sort of emerging liberal thinkers of the time like Locke and Rousseau. And she wrote not only A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, which was her big work advocating for the civil, legal, political advancement of women's rights, but also A Vindication of the Rights of Men, which was to essentially a more broader sort of human rights focused works that focused on defending the French Revolution from more conservative figures of the time, like Burke. Beyond those, she also wrote Reflections on the Revolution in France, which was, again, another sort of defense of the radical, in quotes, revolution in France at the time. And she also wrote on the education, or Thoughts on the Education of Daughters in 1787. So the majority of her scholarship regarding feminism focused on educating girls. So she made a case that women were not overly emotional and that they weren't intellectually inferior to men. She disproved that in her arguments and went on to argue that the education system in England and in most places around the world at the time needed to be radically reformed because they just weren't fit for purpose. They were discriminating against women, half the population, who are not intellectually inferior. They're not overly emotional. They should be getting the same education as boys. She also advocated for increased legal rights for women, more opportunities in employment and in academia and stuff, because she believed that, yeah, a woman could do just as much, if not more, than a man. There is, however, you know, at the time, this is sort of what it was like. There was a bit of a classist influence on the way that she wrote. So she was a sort of, I don't know, sort of pull yourself up by the bootstraps kind of gal, where she would advocate for the rights of women who were, what's the word, more predisposed to greatness, as she sort of put it. So that some women were, they had great things coming for them, you know, they had potential, and other women would be happier staying at home and taking care of kids and stuff. And so there was an element of, well, I'm rich, I'm intelligent, I should have the rights to do what I want. And that other woman who aren't, that's sort of because that's their own fault kind of thing.
Yeah. Sounds like she was a bit of the OG of feminists, you could say. But she obviously still had a little bit to learn. And that just kind of reflects how society was at a whole at that time with the whole classism thing. But yeah, she definitely sounds like a little bit of a legend.
She definitely is. I mean, she is the mother of Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein. Not just Frankenstein, I think she was also a bit of a feminist herself.
Yeah, well, that doesn't surprise me, seeing as how much her mother advocated for the education and the same opportunities for women in education as men.
Yeah.
Or boys, rather.
And at the time, yeah, she was a great intellectual. She went beyond feminism and talked about sort of the prominent political issues of the time. I think later on in her life, she went to America and did like a little guide of traveling. Oh, not America, maybe Iceland. She traveled around the world a lot, which I think for the time for a woman might not have been the most common thing, because they were expected to sort of, you know, be very sedentary, stay home,
yeah, take care of the kids.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, sounds like she's a bit of a jack of all trades. And how cool that she got to travel the world, because, yeah, that's definitely quite enlightening for someone at that time, it would be at least. I guess it's kind of, if you haven't gathered already, so all the episodes thus far have been quite honed in on a specific topic, I would say. And this one's kind of a more broader look at just kind of, yeah, the past and the present and where we're kind of going in terms of feminism, equality, and just what it means to be a woman.
Yeah, hopefully we're going somewhere good.
Yeah, sometimes it's a bit up in the air, but we have to hold on to the hope that we are going up from here.
Yeah, but I guess we could start off with the past.
Yeah,
of feminism.
Do you want to give us a little bit of a history lesson? Because I know that that's your forte.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess for any good starting point would be Mesopotamia, ancient Mesopotamia. We have some of the oldest recorded sort of like legal codes. The Code of Hammurabi is the big one, which is like a big steely, which is just covered head to toe in writing about the laws.
Yeah.
So this is like modern day Iraq kind of area.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So this is like where civilization sort of started out.
Oh, yeah.
And on this big code of law, there is a lot talking about women. Unfortunately, it's nothing particularly progressive.
Or nice.
No, not quite. Women were treated largely like property. So they didn't have as many legal, economic, civil, political rights as men did. There were laws considering adultery. That's not a thing that you see much now.
Yeah.
Adultery isn't really seen as like a crime.
It's more just kind of a religious big no-no. I would say it's tied up into a religion.
Yeah, it's definitely like religious and like socially frowned upon.
Yeah.
Right? It's like you don't really, you know, cheat on someone.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, but is it not in some places it's illegal, right?
In some places it is still illegal.
Yeah.
And there are religious reasons for it. There's also just like social legal reasons. But yeah, in Mesopotamia at the time, adultery could be punished by death. So, you know, if you cheat on your partner as a woman, then the husband who has been, I don't know, adulted, gets to essentially choose whether the woman and the man are put to death. And he can say, like, okay, maybe let's not kill my wife. And so in that case, both of the parties involved in the adultery are spared. It's pretty extreme.
Damn, that's gruesome.
This is unheard of. You wouldn't, you know. And the thing is, yeah, it's all up to the husband. So it's up to the husband whether the wife lives or dies. So if you're like a particularly volatile guy and your wife cheats on you, you know, that's how it is. And again, it's part of that, like, treating them like property. If they don't act like your property, you know, if they start hanging around with other guys, then you're able to, yeah, have them put to death. Crazy.
Yeah.
Beyond Mesopotamia, we have actually one of the more progressive societies is ancient Egypt. So in ancient Egypt, actually, women were legally almost completely equal to men. In some cases, they had more rights than men. In fact, in Egypt, like inheritance and stuff and genealogy was traced matrilineally.
Mm.
So it's depending on like mothers and grandmothers and whatever.
That's so cool.
Yeah, so most inheritance, yeah, it's tracked through like your mothers and stuff. And women could inherit. So women could inherit from, you know, members of the family that died. In a lot of places like ancient Mesopotamia, that wasn't a thing. You couldn't inherit things. Women were engaged in political and religious life. There were women rulers in ancient Mesopotamia. That wasn't really a thing. Queens were sort of, you know, seen more as an accessory to the king. In Egypt, they had prominent pharaohs, so like Nefertiti, Cleopatra, I think the seventh is the most popular one, the Macedonian one, various other Cleopatras. And this was perfectly fine for most people, and they were quite effective rulers. They were quite effective pharaohs at the time. And yeah, you didn't really have that sort of separation of the genders like you did in pretty much most ancient societies. In fact, I would say maybe Egypt is a little bit more advanced in terms of gender equality than some countries even today.
Wow, yeah.
It's like, it's astonishing. Yeah, from what we know, they had pretty much perfect legal equality.
Damn.
And even in like artistic depictions, you'll see like there's no sort of subordination of women in these depictions. They're always depicted pretty much in the same way that men are.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I've also always noticed that in like ancient Egyptian kind of depictions, there's also a lot of respect upheld for animals, like in particular cats. And I feel like that's quite reflective of the fact that if they, I don't know, do you feel like those two things relate?
Yeah, no, I see what you mean. There's like a veneration of, there's no like centering of one thing over the other.
Yeah. It's not like one gender is superior or like humans are superior. It's kind of just like cool.
Yeah, like, yeah. I mean, lots of their gods are like these anthropomorphic, half animal, half human things. And it's, yeah, you really just don't see much of that. There's sort of a depiction of the Egyptians as being like evil conquerors, especially a lot in like sort of the Jewish and Christian mythology of like the Exodus and stuff, which is itself a bit shaky, but that's not something we'll get into. But yeah, broadly, Egyptian society was very, very egalitarian. Even the myth, I want to put this out there, the myth that the pyramids were built by slaves is completely false. It's been proven false since like the 1990s. We know this. They were built by workers who were recompensed with things like bear and meat. So yeah, just for anyone who didn't know. After Egypt, we get to maybe one of the most well-known ancient societies, one that actually conquered Egypt, ancient Rome. In ancient Rome, unfortunately, women were second-class citizens. Yeah. So they weren't like they weren't on the same level as free men. They were slightly above slaves and like freed men, which are like slaves that have been freed. But they weren't like full Roman citizens. So they didn't even have like the legal status of an actual citizen. There were a bunch of laws against women. Again, adultery. Adultery could be punished by a variety of things. And if a man committed adultery, it was less seriously punished than if a woman committed adultery. And this is the thing you see across most ancient societies, is things like adultery and particularly like legal definitions of rape, which is still a thing we see in the modern world today. I think it's like nearly half of all the countries in the world don't have proper legal definitions for things like marital rape and stuff like that. Especially in Rome, that wasn't a thing that ever existed. Like, marital rape was completely fine. It was accepted by them. Again, because there's this view that women are not even citizens, they're more so property. And this is a view in Rome that continues for thousands of years. So past the fall of Rome into the Byzantine Empire and then into medieval Europe, you sort of still have this subordination of woman. And there's like, you know, you get to the Middle Ages, you get Joan of Arc and Eleanor of Aquitaine and all of these big female figures, but mostly nothing much rarely changes until you get to the Renaissance, where you start having humanist thinkers embrace the idea of this broad equality among all humans. And then Mary Wollstonecraft and thinkers like that in the sort of 18th century. And that's where we get to the waves of feminism.
Yes. So I guess that this could kind of be put into like the present category because it's still ongoing. So I've had a little bit of a history lesson. Thank you, Roman. So the first wave of feminism as we know it is majorly associated with the suffragette movement in like the 19th and earliest 20th century, right?
Yeah.
So this is like quite unique because obviously, I mean, I remember learning about this a lot in school because New Zealand is quite proud of how, you know, we had Kate Sheppard, the suffragettes, and we were the first country to give women the right to vote.
Yeah, which is sort of like the bare minimum. Like when people talk about the first wave of feminism, it's like the bare minimum legal recognition.
Yeah, literally. And it's once again, like women weren't seen as citizens or like they were still being seen as property. And why would you need to give property the right to vote? And it's like people were scared to give
like more power.
Yeah. People were scared once women got an inkling of the power that they could have, that everything would turn to crap.
Yeah, that men would be sort of unseated from their position of power that they have over women, where women don't have any say over the politics of their country that's dominated by men.
Yeah, and I see this still today, and it's, I think it's a very masculine way of thinking that when women, this is kind of a weird analogy, but like, say women, we lived in a society where women were in charge of everything, like, and men were second-class citizens. I feel like a lot of men fear that women would then treat men so badly out of, like, revenge and out of vengeance.
I definitely get what you mean, where it's like they think that political power necessarily means some sort of violent control.
Yeah, and I'm like, to be honest, I don't really blame them because of how badly like men have treated women in the past. I would be a little bit scared too then if women would get into power. But in saying that, as a woman, I have no desire to take revenge over all mankind or like, men specifically. I just want equality or like equity for all.
Just sort of people to be able to live their lives with dignity.
Yeah.
And that means everyone. That doesn't mean excluding certain groups of
people. Exactly. Because then if you're going too far the other way and you're excluding men or making them feel less than, then it's just a cycle. Like it's a vicious
then
cycle.
It's just as good as like, what we have now with patriarchal systems of control and masculinity. They're built off oppression.
Exactly.
So, yeah, if you look at actually, I remember that I saw a poll that reflected what I think it was in the UK Parliament would look like if the voting population was entirely women.
Mm.
And it was like mostly like green.
Yeah.
So it's like there's a politics there. And I don't think it's like it's not maybe an inherent thing, but it's because of their position as being so marginalized.
Mm.
Because it's like left-wing politics. With the Green Party, there's a more acute focus on, say, the environment and on social equality. Whereas if it was the opposite, if it was men, you'd see maybe mostly like in the UK, like conservative. So it's interesting to see there's a divide in politics there.
Yeah. I guess you could definitely say that is like second wave of feminism, which came about in like 1960s to 1980s, and a growing awareness of women's personal lives as a basis for political understanding and social change.
Mm.
Like this kind of second wave was kind of the time when domestic violence, reproductive rights, sexual violence and workplace rights were like really coming into the limelight, like a lot of kind of social movements and more like consciousness and like a growing shared understanding, I guess you could say. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, advancing beyond the bare minimum of like legal rights and freedoms, you get activity in political life. There's a focus in international relations on feminism and why there is such little amounts of representation for women in governments across the world. It's still, I think, something like globally 30% of parliaments around the world is women.
Yeah. I guess kind of like if you're using the waves of feminism, then like the one now is like, well, there's a lot of discourse about like if there's a fourth wave.
Yeah, there's like third and fourth wave feminism. I think fourth wave goes more into sort of like postmodern, post-structural sort of discourses. Third wave.
Yeah.
It focuses on things like decolonization.
Yeah, intersectionality.
Yeah.
Stuff that we've talked about in the past episodes. And I think also we talked about it maybe a little bit in our Is There a Right Way to Be a Feminist episode? Kind of like a bit more of the radical feminism. I feel like, was that second or was that third wave? Maybe a bit of both.
I think radical feminism is like a reaction.
Yeah.
To, at least if we're thinking like radical feminism is in like TERFism.
Yeah.
It's definitely, I think, a reaction to third wave feminism, because third wave feminism has a big focus on intersectionality and different identities. So like trans women as part of feminist movements, and radical feminism like TERFism explicitly rejects that.
Yeah. I think third wave for me, like what I kind of recognize, is a lot more like connection between ideas. I don't know if that makes sense. Wait. Is it like the Me Too movement?
Kind of. I think Me Too is sort of second wave-ish. Like third wave is moving beyond political life and focusing on sort of, well, with intersectionality, you have like the different identities. So like woman of color or woman of lower class in different parts of the world will have different needs, different aspirations, different goals to, say, Western white feminists, who has sort of dominated the first and second waves of feminism, right?
Yeah.
That largely sort of sets the developing world and people of color and indigenous people, people of lower classes, sort of to the side.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess it's kind of like the waves of feminism often get critiqued because it's not like feminism itself is not a super linear thing. Like it doesn't follow all these kind of rigid sections that you're like putting into place. And I feel like it's quite a, again, it comes back to that whole like Western thing of needing to define and have a kind of category and allegation for everything, when in actual fact, if like when we were talking about the past section of this episode, some of these ideas have been around for like so long, and like people have been fighting for these things, for these rights, for these for the recognition for so long, and attributing to them to like just coming into play in a certain wave kind of undermines the hard work that's gone into a lot of people's life's work, like the historic figure for this week.
I definitely get what you mean. Even if we go back a bit to the past for a second and compare it to the present, like, again, we have obviously very patriarchal, very oppressive sort of societies like Mesopotamia and Rome, but you also have Egypt, places that are in maybe some aspects more equal for women than places around the world today. Even like just the idea of development, it's not necessarily linear. And it's not always going to be forwards progress. If you look at the Islamic world, for instance, in the areas where Islam first developed, so around the Middle Ages and the Islamic Golden Age, you actually saw significant advances in women's rights. So the introduction of Islamic law at the time encouraged women actually to seek education. Women would be involved in a variety of trades around the Islamic world during the Golden Age, so including getting, there was a sort of like degree that you could get to become like a scholar, and women were allowed to get these degrees as well. Women, in fact, in some places, because they could own their own businesses, had monopolies on things, especially like weaving and tapestry and stuff. So they were very broadly encouraged to take part in society actively. The introduction of Islamic law to areas of the Middle East and Africa often started to ban practices like forced marriage, including like child marriage in certain parts of the world. And it's a bit controversial, the child marriage part, but definitely forced marriage of women. You needed the consent of a woman to actually marry her. In a lot of places before the introduction of Islam, you could just sort of sell someone off as property. Again, we talked about Mesopotamia, it's around the same area, and it was vastly different. And now it's sort of that same religion, Islam, is being characterized as something that's the complete antithesis of that. There was immense, amazing progress in the Middle Ages and the Islamic Golden Age, and now people see that completely differently. They see it as a force of like backwards progress, or at least, you know, people who like to portray it that way. So
yeah, I guess that brings us to the kind of future section of the episode. And it's, I often find it quite hard, because if we zoom in on New Zealand as a whole, we like to think we're very progressive in terms of women's rights, just given the fact of the whole suffragette movement and stuff. But I think it's so easy for us to compare ourselves to other countries and be like, again, we talked about this on the Indigenous episode, but kind of comparing ourselves to other countries and saying, well, we've done more than them, so obviously we're doing a good job. But I think that that's just not good enough. Like, we need to be looking at the country as a whole, and a lot of stuff that's come into light this year politically, I think, have been like very targeted to the rights of women, like the rollback of the pay equity laws. So many women are going to be impacted. And I just think we can't be claiming to lead the way when so many women in this country are still struggling socially, financially, physically, mentally, every single day. And that's not to undermine that men aren't as well, but it's just to say that we can't be claiming to be on top while simultaneously neglecting our role to equity. I think that if anything, for the future portion of this video, if I can really reiterate one thing, it is to vote, get out there and, you know, use the autonomy that we've been given, that women have fought for us to have the choice to vote, and do your research, vote for who's going to do the best thing for you. That is one big thing I will say. I know so many of my friends, they don't really know who to vote for or different parties' policies. And I don't blame them, because I think that there's not a lot of education about the New Zealand political system in high school, or how to vote and what it kind of means to vote and the importance of voting. And another thing I just wanted to bring up, sorry, I'm jumping around a lot, but I would say for me, a big kind of thing that I learned about recently in terms of the future of feminism is ecofeminism. So this is like kind of a folk, it's been around for a while, but I think it's quite relevant to the future in terms of climate justice and climate change. And just kind of ecofeminism is a branch of feminism that examines the connections between women and nature and how they're both kind of treated by the patriarchy. Yeah, from my understanding, ecofeminism is kind of just talking about how women and nature are both oppressed. And I was learning from my lecturer that a lot of the time, the blame, or not the blame, but the responsibility of climate justice and upkeeping the climate gets put onto women because of this nurture and nature kind of perception. And a lot of men kind of just view it as a woman's job to protect the planet and care for animals and care for nature, which I find really interesting. I hadn't made that connection before.
Yeah, I think that goes definitely into the concept of gender essentialism, which was something that Mary Wollstonecraft herself wrote against. And making her argument for the education of women and girls. Yeah, assuming that women have this innate, natural capacity to sort of, like advocate for nature, it's a very dubious, and things like gender essentialism can always be used to not only marginalize women, cis women, trans women, it can be used for any sort of purpose. You can just say that women are naturally meant to be subservient. That's gender essentialism. And that's a thing I will say about the future, definitely, is we've seen, I think, throughout the episode that societies change significantly over time. And no two societies are the same. Obviously, we've seen development of feminism in Western society, but who knows where that'll go? We could definitely go backwards. In fact, I think in a lot of places we are going backwards with rollbacks and things like abortion in the United States. So it's important to be conscious of these things and to be really aware that despite all of the progress we've made, it's very possible that in the future, maybe not even in the far future, we could be living in a very, very different society with very different norms around gender.
Yes. Hence the name of the episode, Back to the Future. I think that's pretty much all we can talk about today. But next week's our last episode, so be sure to give that a listen. We'll be giving a brief kind of conclusion of how the season went, and we can't wait to see you there.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.